Okay, let's get going. It's a big day today for some of us. Agenda for today is information about the students' final presentations, assignments, remaining assignments for the students. More importantly, the celebration on Thursday, and then we'll have the student presentations. So, first thing is that everybody should have an evaluation form, and Laura doesn't have one, so you can pass this to her, and you don't have one either. And Wade should have one too. We have eight teams presenting, and they'll each have 8 minutes, which is a very short time, so they have to be very concise, so they're not going to be able to cover every little thing in detail, but there will be an opportunity on Thursday. Students will bring their projects to the end-of-term celebration, and you'll have a chance to see them demonstrate them and ask them questions face-to-face. So that's during class time. We'll meet in class at our normal time. We'll fill out a course evaluation form, and then we'll adjourn, have some food, and have a good time. Okay, so for the students, the three students who have done individual projects, their reports are due today. If you need more time, let me know. For teams, their final reports are due on Monday. Again, if you need a little more time to do a better job, you know, just let me know, and chances are I will give you that extra time. There's still a few students who have missed lectures. Please come and talk to me about that. And for students who have want to get reimbursed for some of their project expenses, there is a web page that explains the procedure. Please pass this back. Okay. So for Thursday, the end-of-term celebration, we'll meet in here, and we'll have fill out the evaluation form for the course, and then I'm going to bring some burritos and pizza. So sign up if you haven't already signed up for that here, so I know how much to get on Thursday. And that ought to be fun. Everybody is welcome. So anybody who's here today is welcome to attend, and anybody who has been here in the past who's filled out an evaluation form is also welcome. Okay. So that the celebration is in that area just beyond the building in the nice wooded area called Gibbons Grove. So we have eight teams today, and this is the order of presentation. So without further ado, I think we'll get going unless there's any questions. Okay, let's do it. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kevin McCabe. This is my partner, Beth Shields, and together we make up Team ProApps, which stands for Progressive Applications. This quarter, we looked into our project called Discovery Motion, and it is an iPad game that helps with the socio-development of students with autism.
To give you a little bit of background information on autism is a developmental disorder. It's usually detected within the first 3 years of life, and it affects the development of social and communication skills. Currently, autism affects about 1 in 88 children, although that number is increasing. And we work specifically with PACE, which is the Pacific Autism Center for Education. They serve about 60 students who are sort of all across the autistic spectrum, although they do have a fair number of students with more severe cases of autism.
So the problem we were looking at addressing this quarter was the fact that people with autism have trouble with socio-emotional cues, and in particular have trouble discerning between different facial expressions. So for example, a person with autism would have trouble distinguishing between the six emotions you see up on the slide. Now this is of particular importance to us because studies have shown that early assistance with the social and behavioral development of students with autism can have a positive impact early on in life.
So we started the quarter by connecting some interviews, first with Kurt, who's the director at PACE, as well as some of the PACE staff members, the therapists and the aides there. And we also spoke to two former students of this class who developed a different application for students with autism last year. And sort of some of the takeaway points from these interviews, Kurt mentioned to us that most of the existing applications that he's seen focus on communication rather than on emotion recognition. Also, everyone that we spoke with emphasized the importance of a sense of realism in the application, in the photos and videos that you present, in order to help the students translate what they're learning to their everyday lives.
In addition to some of the interviews we conducted, we did a bit of research into the existing solutions that are out on the market right now. We primarily encountered iPad apps and interactive DVDs, and with doing so, we encountered some of the problems with those as well. Namely, there was not a lot of options for customization or personalization. So as you can see, the three apps or DVDs that we found all come with a preloaded set of data, whether it be emotions, definitions, or situations. Additionally, one of the problems that we noticed was that they can be quite expensive. If you look in the top right corner, that's an interactive DVD that we found that does add that sense of realism that we're looking for. However, the price tag of $90 can be pretty limiting to people, students and parents.
So for our research, we wanted to look at the first step of social processing, which is recognizing emotions in facial expressions and design a game to help with that skill. We also wanted to design a game that was pretty simple and easy to use with the hopes that students would use it frequently in order to really cement what they were learning throughout the game. We also wanted to keep in mind what we learned throughout those interviews, that the sense of realism is really important. And finally, we wanted to add a sense of familiarity in the pictures that the students were encountering in the game, because we think that that's sort of the biggest thing that's missing on the market currently.
So with that in mind, and after sitting down with some of the staff at PACE and some of the therapists there, in addition to some of the brainstorming we did ourselves, we came up with a long list of customizable settings for our app. As you can see at the bottom, the most important factor we considered in adding to our app was the sense of familiarity, because we felt, as Beth mentioned, that it was important for students to be able to apply the skills that they learned to real-world scenarios. And after coming up with this list, we developed our paper prototype, which we showed during a midterm presentation. As you can see, it's a simple picture matching game with where students match the emotion on the top row to the correct picture on the bottom row. You can also see the feedback mechanism we had, the lights surrounding the edge of the board. And after that, we took it down to PACE for our first round of testing. We were able to get some very positive feedback from some of the students, which we were able to incorporate into our iPad app.
So I'm going to take you through some screenshots of our final application so you can get a sense of how it works. This is our load screen, so that's what comes up when you first enter the application, and it has two options, over here to play the game or to add pictures. So if you click on this play game button, it takes you into this screen. As you can see, it closely resembles our paper prototype. There's the word for an emotion and an example picture on the top row, and then there's two pictures to choose from below. Each of those is a button, so the students just click on the picture that matches the emotion. And then if they get it right, the picture will spin around, and three new pictures will be loaded to move on to the next round. So if you go back to that main screen and click on Add Pictures instead, It takes you to this table, which is everyone who's loaded into the game. And from here, you can either choose someone to edit their photos or add new photos into the game. Then that'll take you to this screen for each individual person. You add in their name, and then click on each of those six buttons to add in six emotional photos. So then this is going to be Kurt's page for Happy. And if you click on this camera right here, it pops up the camera on the iPad. You make a happy face, take a picture, and then that's automatically loaded into the game. So that'll start randomly appearing throughout the picture matching in the game.
So after we finished coding this app, we took it down to Pace once again to do some testing and gather some feedback. But before doing so, we were able to take some pictures of the therapists and staff at Pace in order to really get a sense of how that familiarity that we added would have an impact on the testing. And so after testing it with some of the students, we were able to get some very good, very productive feedback, especially in terms of the familiarity that we added. A lot of students commented throughout using the app on the familiarity and the fact that they recognized people in the game, and we could tell that they were much more engaged than before. Additionally, some students thought that there could be some more exciting, positive feedback, whereas others were less concerned with that. A few students also mentioned an opportunity to add more of a social aspect to the game where you would be able to play it with some of your friends.
Then we took the therapist who watched the students playing the game to get some additional feedback from them. One of the things that they emphasized was making sure that the interface was really robust to different motor skills. Some of the students were more inclined to double tap pictures really quickly or press and hold things for long periods of time, and we really want to make sure that the app sort of accommodates that range of motor skills. Also, they mentioned that our simple interface was good and that we should avoid adding extraneous pictures and symbols around the screen as they can provide a distraction to the students. And finally, they were interested in seeing the output metrics from the game. They mentioned in particular that with some of their non-verbal students, that would be really helpful in order to tell which emotions were easier or more difficult for those students to recognize.
So with all this in mind and the quarter coming to a close, we've looked at the future of Discover Emotion and what direction it could be heading in. As Beth mentioned, there is a definite need to make the system more robust. Additionally, one of the things that we noticed throughout the quarter was it was very difficult to make some of the emotions that we wanted to see in the game. And so we considered adding a user guide or a set of instructions or perhaps some example pictures in order for the user to follow that more closely. Additionally, data output is a huge thing that we would like to consider adding as well. The ability to track the metrics for each session and output them to a very understandable way is very important, we think. There's always more room for adding customizable settings. And in the future, we hope to release this to the App Store one day and provide this educational tool for as many people as possible.
Finally, just have some thank yous.
Thank you.
Anybody have any questions for the team?
I'll come
back.
I don't know much about voice, but can you describe audio?
That was, so asking about audio in the game? Yeah, that was one of the things that the therapist mentioned. They do have some students who don't read yet, and we were using the example picture to try to help those students a little bit, but that was one of the features that we also had suggested to us to add into the game, was a spoken expression of the emotion.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, in the game, you give an aware of the emotion and then like an example picture and then you choose between the two. Will people just be like looking for similar facial characters between like the example picture and the other two, or is that something you want?
It really depends on the student and what helps them learn more. Throughout the game, we ask them what helps you more, looking at the picture or looking at the word, and in determining what emotion you choose. And a lot of them did, in fact, kind of match the facial characteristics between the two pictures. What we'd like to see is them kind of associate that with the word itself, but some students were just not quite at that level. One more. Yeah, especially after we added some of the staff there, they really started enjoying seeing some of the people they know make weird facial expressions. One more in the back.
Yes, excellent work.
Thank you.
One question I have is, have you thought about gender-serious demographics? far as pictures are concerned?
In terms of the pictures that we take of people?
Yes, I mean the photos and things that are preloaded, there's no customization support.
Right.
That's excellent. But the ones that are preloaded, the ones that are on here already, because there may be some research that says people look at people as, for instance, different gender, different
sure.
ethnicity.
Sure.
They look at them differently. Mm-hmm. So they may have the same facial expression and interpret it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering if you had thought about that.
That's, yeah.
That's a great idea for the preloaded
set. Thanks, I think we have to move on.
Thank you.
I
should mention that the students have been working on these projects since the beginning of the year, so it represents about 8 weeks of work.
Which means monkey hand in Spanish, and it's a prosthesis that allows kids to do the monkey bars. So we're going to talk about the problem we have, our need finding and brainstorming ideas, our concepts, and then our testing and final conclusions. So the problem we have was to create a device for a child with upper limb amputation that helps him or her do the monkey bars with their friends. So far, there's been nothing that addresses this problem.
For those few of you who aren't familiar with monkey bars, we got our friends Tamara to be our baseline, our control group, if you will. Here are several images of her using the device on an actual jungle gym, just swinging across. You can see how she advances her hand one after the other. Now her legs just flail and fly all over the place, and that's part of what makes it fun. You're moving forward without using your feet.
So since there's nothing that currently helps kids do the monkey bars, we looked at related problems. So first look at harnesses and devices that hold someone's weight up while they're doing activities. So look at construction and sailing and rock climbing. And most of the things we found have harnesses around people's legs to load weight, but that's not the direction we wanted to go in because it could be cumbersome and we weren't quite sure if we wanted to have a kid have to put a harness on every time they wanted to do the monkey bars. We also talked to Gary Burke about, he's a prosthetist in Redwood City, about different prostheses, and he said that they're very comfortable if you push inside the prosthetic arm, but when you start to pull away, if you put a force on away from the body, you tend to slide out and it is not so secure. We also looked at sports prostheses and weight-bearing hooks to see how current prosthetic designers design prostheses so that they're durable yet still allow the user to be competitive.
A number of different ideas that we brainstormed fell into generally three different classes. One notion was change the environment, add something to the jungle gym itself that allows a one-handed user to use the equipment that exists. Create a standalone prosthesis, and most of the ideas that we had in this category involved a harness of some kind or other, whether grab the upper body, mid-body, or a loop went way down to the foot. The last class of notion involved creating just a special end effector that would plug into some custom-made socket. Now, the stuff that last class seemed impossible to us at first. The big revelation that made it possible was the realization that we needed to change the iconic monkey bar using posture, angling one arm pointed downwards, the partial arm pointing downwards. That allowed us to create a situation in which we had an end effector far distant from the interaction with the human body, the socket plugged into the end of the amputated arm. That made that idea possible.
So one thing that we debated was a standalone versus adding on the hook to an existing prosthesis. The benefits of the standalone device is that it has an added factor of safety because it's one whole device that's pre-assembled and it's very structurally sound. The downside, though, is that you need a prosthetic arm that is molded specifically for a person. And so it'll be a little bit more expensive. The one thing we think, though, is that maybe we can use the same mold that the prosthetist already has for that patient for their existing prosthesis. For the add-on, it'll be less expensive because you don't need that mold. The one thing, though, is that it might reduce the factor of safety because you have to find a way to securely fit around an existing prosthesis and without being too cumbersome or too complicated, and has to be able to do it quickly.
So the notion there in terms of colors is just that the blue would be the entire thing together, and here the orange is presumed to be what the user already has. The green would be added on to that. For prototyping this concept, we figured we could make something that enabled a two-handed person to mimic the same motion that we've been projecting. This involves making a brace that wraps around a two-handed person's wrist, fixing their hand and preventing wrist motion from contributing to the usage of the device. That connected to a rod, which leads up to a hook that would interact with the monkey bar itself. And here's a couple pictures of what we predicted it would look like in use. Note, this was our goal for the quarter, simply to create a proof of concept model that demonstrates that the posture in question could be used effectively and in a fun way to use the monkey bars.
So the first thing I had to do was make a hook. So I took a steel rod, heated it up until it was that orange. You can see this picture here doesn't have great contrast, but I heated up the rod until it was really, really, really hot, bent it around a bunch of cylinders until I got a shape that I liked. The first hook, which is here, we found that the point of contact for the apex of the curve of the hook was actually not in line with the rod, so that when you loaded it, the hook just slid off the bar. So I reshaped it, bending it a little bit more back, and now the point of contact is in line, and so when you hang it on the monkey bar from the right and put a little bit of load, it hangs beautifully.
Prototyping this was a lot of fun. Materials we used of note involved two-sided Velcro that's hooked on one side, loop on the other. It's 2 inches wide, really tough and durable. It's basically like reusable duct tape. Great stuff. We used it everywhere in the thing. The main construction here is a couple ski poles I bought from Goodwill for cheap that we hacked up, chopped with a hacksaw, and put together. The one most important thing to note, I guess, is that we hid a one-inch thick, one-inch-wide strap through one of the poles. It wraps up and around the hook and straight back down to the user's hand, which makes it so that all of the weight transfers straight from the hook through the strap to the hand. That prevents a lot of wiggle from improper tolerancing and prototyping. Anyway, worked out pretty fine. Middle picture there is me lifting Paul off the ground and on the steps that are in the atrium in building 550. There was a little wiggling around that needed to be fixed and addressed, but after we got that done, we were ready to go out and use the thing.
So I was the test dummy. I wore a helmet to make sure if I fell, I didn't get a concussion. But I didn't fall at all, which was nice. So what I found was that it was really comfortable to hold it down here with a light glove on. I could wear it for hours on the monkey bars, no stress at all in my hand. My other hand was not so comfortable. I don't know how kids do it. My hand was really sore on the monkey bar. We also found that the hook length, so this length here, is really important because if you make it too long, it'll hit both bars when you're moving from bar to bar. So you need to take into account the spacing of monkey bars. I also found that if I move my shoulder back a little bit, not too extreme, but just small shoulder twisting as I release the hook, it came off pretty easily, so that's promising as a release mechanism. I had this on for a pretty long time, and it was comfortable. It wasn't too heavy, but I could tell that if it was any heavier, it might be cumbersome, and I might not want it on for much longer, so we need to keep it light in the final design. As Gary Burke mentioned with people who can tighten their own prosthesis, they tend to crank it down and tighten it because it feels better. It feels like it'll stay on. What I experienced, too, was I just kept wanting to make the arm band tighter, but it didn't need to be. We did find a happy medium where it was tight and comfortable and safe, but not too tight so that it would squeeze my arm. Lastly, it was designed for me. It worked for me, but it also worked for Sane and didn't break, which was nice.
Considerations for future development. One question we had was the posture of the arm. Should the arm be straight down? We predicted some relations that involved a bent arm, something that puts the hook a little closer to the forearm. We could address the hook shape. Maybe if it's wider, there's a longer line of arm contacts that could give some more sensory feedback to the user to let them know when the hook is fully engaged. There's the standalone versus attachment iterations, which we discussed earlier, and there's the aesthetic insert. What should this actually look like? A lizard tail or a monkey hand, something we could make it more fun for kids if they'd like.
We'd like to thank Gary Burke and Dave Jaffe for their support. We'll take any questions, and we have a few pictures. As a note, I am not posing. This is during testing. Stain is posing.
Pictures since we have questions.
What happens when somebody loses their grip? Sort of do a hazard analysis about stabbing themselves in the head or something.
No, I did occasionally lose my grip by like trying too hard to get off, but I just landed on the ground, didn't hit myself. But we should look into that. Hopefully we won't use steel and be pointy in the end.
Yep.
It'll be a little bit more kid friendly.
A lot of that could be addressed in close
on the next to the last slide. You actually had one that was folded over, and it was like a double version of that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Bottom right hand corner is like a
touch
left
geometry.
Yeah.
And it could be made out of plastic too, so it's lighter as well as it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
The question?
So when you're actually trying to use the monkey bars, have you tried like seeing the motion of like unhooking it and then putting it on the other forefoot? Like, is it easy to do?
So with this hook, not yet, just because I left a lot of length on so that if we needed to re-bend it, I had something to hold onto. It's possible if I cut it shorter, I could do that. It was easy for me to get off. I haven't yet tried getting onto the next one. Also, I haven't done the monkey bars in forever, so just couldn't stay on very long with my good hand. I was like struggling. Yeah.
Other questions?
Could it be used further in the playground as well? I mean, could you think of other
there are a couple other climbing and swinging activities that are around the monkey bars sometimes. Now I wish that I added some other pictures to this. We had one where there's two rings, you like flip yourself upside down.
No.
So, possibilities. So we haven't really addressed anything other than this specific task, but we could.
One more.
Yes, I think that it's worth it.
Yeah. We're not sure. The one thing is that the jungle gym is inherently unsafe as it is. it's like I fell off a lot of scrapes and bruises. As a kid, not on this. With everything, you have to suggest, being safer. And of course, if we do make this a product people can get, we will explain that it's not completely safe. We need to talk to parents about that. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Next, we have touch of a button.
Palo Alto, She was a community member of the club last year. She contacted us because she survived from stroke 15 years ago, and she doesn't have nerve sensations in her right hand and arm. And because of that, it's harder to dress, sometimes taking upwards to an hour, and having to resort to wearing more t-shirts as opposed to clothes with buttons and other fasteners. So we realized that this was a bigger problem than we originally thought. And Tatiko also helped with testing our cuff button aid, which we'll show later. Some statistics. 41,000 persons have upper limb amputations. Specifically, we wanted to focus on unilateral transradial amputation, which refers to a below elbow amputation on just one arm. This is projected to increase in the future, meaning that there may be a greater need for button dress aids. For persons with stroke, one condition is hemiparesis, which is the loss of mobility of one side of your body. And that affects 80% of persons surviving from stroke. So this was also a need. So for our design challenge, we designed cuff and jean button aids for persons surviving from stroke or persons with upper limb amputations. And we really wanted to help, you know, increase the person's independence and help them have an easier lifestyle, just because this is something you do on a daily basis. So Ray will go over existing solutions.
There are many existing solutions for buttoning. However, they rarely address cuff buttons or jean buttons. The Good Grips button hook is great for shirt buttons, but you don't have a hand to use to button your cuffs, and the wire is too flimsy and thin to actually button jeans. The Magic Button Aid for jeans is only useful if the jeans already come together on their own. It is useless if there's any tension across the jeans already. The Pocket Dresser has many different hooks and loops for zippers and buttons. However, it is quite heavy and bulky to carry on yourself at all times. And Velcro and other adaptive clothing require you to give to others to sew on or purchasing at a more expensive price. The jeans still require them to come together on their own, and Velcro is very easily dirtied.
So I'll go over our design concepts and some criteria for our improved design. So we have function, portability, aesthetics, and cost. We wanted something affordable specifically. For function, there are differences between cuff buttons and jean buttons. For a jean button, as Ray mentioned, was the tension between the button and the buttonhole size. And for the cuff buttons, you lack a gum, you lack one hand, two buttons, your dominant hand. And so we kept that in mind when we were designing the Grips Boom. So this is our first product, which is not cuff to cuff, which we presented in our last midterm presentation. So it's just comprised of two very simple parts, just having a cuff chain where the buttonhole is and a clip on the other side. And you can basically just snap it on. You can just put it like across like the wall or just on yourself. Right now, the clip is metal, so yeah. But we also considered, you know, what materials we can use and how to improve the design. So we ended up choosing magnet versus snap-on fasteners because magnets were more secure and it was easier to fasten. It was very quick. We chose an alligator clip as opposed to a safety pin because we realized that if you only have one hand and one arm, it'll be very difficult to use a safety pin in particular. So those were reasons for our choices. So this is just our final design. And you know, one of the improvements was also putting the bottom part of the magnet closer to the edge of the clip, just because it won't show as much. So it won't show as much. And that's what we realized when we were testing it with Tatiko. So that was very helpful.
Our second product is the RK Jean Buttoner, RK being our initials. And so the first prototype is just simply a strap with a loop at the end. The idea is to feed the strap through the buttonhole, put the loop around the button, and just pull it through the buttonhole until the button's secure. However, we realized that this does not work at all. The button gets stuck right before the buttonhole and will not come through. And we also realized that you need constant pulling it, otherwise the jeans will come apart. The second prototype, we added a small hook at the end of the strap such that we can zip up the zipper on the jeans. That way when you pull it close and zip up the jeans will not fall apart again. Then we replace the strap with a rigid hook. That way we can use it to twist and pull it through the buttonhole until it comes through the buttonhole. The great thing about this is it works. And it's still small, and we have the ability to zip up the pants. However, the main concern about this is we noticed that constant use of this would cause wear and tear on the buttonhole due to the friction of the string through the buttonhole. So we added an extra hook and a loop onto our design. This way, we simply put the loop hook through the buttonhole and the loop around the button. That way when you pull it together, there is no friction on the buttonhole anymore. We once again used the small hook at the end of the string to pull up the zipper. And then we hook the silver hook onto the button and pull it through and twist the button into place again. Now that the pants are securely fastened, you can either keep the hook on the pants and slide the string into your pocket, or if you want, you can remove the whole thing and also keep it in your pocket. It's very portable. The instructions may take some practice getting used to, but in the end, it is much easier to use. It is made of very cheap components and easy to store.
Okay, so moving forward, these are just some future considerations if we had more resources and more time. So for the laptop to cup, we realized that might be a little bit bulky. We could make it thinner, the magnet, as well as having it weaker because it might be difficult to unfasten if it's too strong. And we also wanted some covering on the bottom of the cup so it doesn't, you know, irritate the skin.
We also want to change the material of the alligator clip to be maybe aluminum such that it is not magnetic and will not interfere with a magnet.
Yeah, and then for the RK jean buttoner, we wanted thinner hooks so that it can fit more comfortably around the button when it's fastened on the jean. And one of the huge concerns was if the hooks are going to catch on other fabric or like other parts of the body. So we would also work on that if we had more time. We also want to thank Sachiko for helping us with testing our prototype.
And coming and being our, you know, guinea pig.
And then we want to thank Gary Bird for giving us advice as well. Thank you.
Questions? It's so good and clear. Oh, okay.
I thought maybe something like a magnetic tip. If you say you pick up nails in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, to help with connecting the magnet from the clothing.
You mean on the cuff? The thing is, because your dominant hand has the cusp around you already. The only way you can use that is if you, like, use this hand to operate it. You can't use this hand anymore. So we try to eliminate creating a tool for you to use. It needs to be completely replacing the button such that you can, like, at most use a surface to put the button on. That's our main goal.
And I think it was cool because you can take it off and put on your other clothes. So, like, it wasn't a permanent thing. Like, I just take this off and then, like, yeah. Thank you.
Did you guys see that there's going to be out on the market stretchy for you with a little button on it?
Yeah, I didn't know that. Okay.
I didn't see that. I didn't
know. We did consider, but I felt like when it makes it longer such that it won't fit as well because it's mainly made to if it's too small you put that on and it's an extension and it's also very noticeable. I felt like you can definitely see the strings and stuff, and we really didn't want that. We want it to be like aesthetically pleasing.
The thing is,
we want to to avoid Velcro, because Velcro, like, we did buy some Velcro, and it got dirty really, really easily, and it's very, it's not pleasant to use. It scratches the skin often, and you require someone else to sew it on. And
there's a certain stigma with it as well.
Yeah.
We wanted, like, another option.
And we're also afraid that it might not be secure. Like, it could come off at any time. And for acting, you're on stage for a short time, but in real life, you don't want that to happen.
Yeah. And just to know, we tried to find persons at the VA hospital, but I think most of the patients didn't live nearby, so it was hard to find other users as well. So we just take that into
consideration. Did you use it?
Right.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. I'm Matt, this is Tommy, and this is Will. This is our problem statement, kind of a review of what we went over in the midterm. We want to tackle the problem of sets of 1 to 2 and up to 3 steps in a home. We had a few interviews with people related to the project, first with Jack, our product sponsor, and from us he wanted something new and novel that he hadn't seen before, and there was really nothing on the market that addressed this issue. With Morgan, she said that she really didn't want anything to attach to a wheelchair because it's already noticeable enough. And she specifically cited Casa Tariana on campus as a place that has sets of stairs that she really can't access. And then Linda Evans, she gave us some advice on the challenges for universal design, specifically transitions. Here's our statement of need. We want to people with mobility impairments to safely navigate houses with non-obvious steps or sets of steps. And these are the three kind of things we divided into. Here's a 90-hour problem. Just some stats about the number of multiple-story houses and the aging population. And as you can see, this population is large and is ever-growing. And here are some existing solutions out there today. Ramps, lifts, wheelchair assists, climbing wheelchairs, exoskeletons, and stair aids. And in our brainstorming process, this is our initial brainstorming designs. We had a few different categories. The top left is ramps, or things that we would put up to an existing set of stairs. Over to the right, something that would be carried by a wheelchair user. And over here is modifications to a wheelchair. And in narrowing down these brainstorming decisions, we use these criteria to do that. First, we thought about the different users, whether those with wheelchairs, scooters, canes, and then the different types of devices, as I mentioned before, permanent, modular, fixed to another device. And considerations that pertain to all of them were the setup time, the ease of use, aesthetics, and cost.
Yeah, so like Matt said, we looked at brainstorming different kinds of hydraulic lifts and exoskeletons, but at the end of the day, we ended up staying with something that people have been using for a long time, which is just a basic ramp, which we were sort of hesitant to. We had this original prototype we presented last time. After presenting, we went back to the drawing board, and some of the issues that were raised were whether a ramp is really more aesthetically pleasing than existing ramps. Questions about the material and the manufacturing process. We're considering using aluminum, which is expensive and kind of hard to work with. often, but lots of times, if it's around, you're not going to need to access real often. It can be a waste of space when it's not being used. And it often doesn't blend well with the environment, especially if it's a retrofitted ramp built after the house was already designed. The other option are portable ramps, which are good to, you know, if you need something to throw in your car, if you're not sure if you're going to be going to place with an accessible ramp. They're usually kind of an eyesore to have in your house. They draw a lot of attention to the user, and they're usually a generic model, so they don't necessarily fit the ramp in your house perfectly. And so we knew there was clearly a need for a better ramp. So what we decided to do was come up with a novel business model, which would be designing a ramp to customly fit every, that would be unique to the staircase that it's designed for, using a lightweight, affordable material that looks well in the house. And so some key benefits of this design are that it's custom, so it will always look well, the staircase that it acts on. And it's been perfectly set to the maximum 6188 ventilation slope for residential use. And so, like Matt said, we decided to choose the steps from the first floor of the lounge and Casa Italiana, because when you had a mortgage, that was the set of steps that you wish you could access the most on campus. And so it's just a picture of the steps we were prototyping for final design. And here's the CAD model for our specific ramp for the stairs in the lounge. So we carefully measured the slope and the cutout and the profile of the stairs. And we modeled our prototype using Foamular 250, which is a type of insulation that can handle a really high compressive load. It's also pretty cheap and easy to work with. And so now I'll let Will explain some of our demonstrations of our prototype.
Yeah, so these were some initial testing. Again, I was testing a bit. Possibly should have been wearing a helmet, but unfortunately did not need it. So we've got some up and down the ramp on a manual wheelchair. We've got some videos that will come up. So. Essentially pretty straightforward. Works as expected. The ramp itself is lightweight. It's modular in its design. And also, we worked very hard to blend it with the environment, getting the right paint and the right surface finish on the top as well. This is going up the steps. So this is some initial testing. We're also going to be testing with Morgan in her power wheelchair. Today we're trying to coordinate a time that works for her and her quarter. Everyone's got very busy schedules, so hopefully we'll have some stuff to show on Thursday with Morgan.
So we're really trying to add value here of having a custom ramp that's very aesthetically pleasing and fits with the environment in the home, all at a lower cost and so our user experience, basically the customer who is looking for a ramp, and this could be someone with mobility impairment, someone with small children, or any number of things, basically orders from us online, on the phone, or in-store, whichever is easiest. And we have someone from a local home retailer come out and do a scan, essentially, of the steps. The beauty is we've got a lot of new developing technology these days. This was done simply with my iPhone, and you can get a very good profile of the stairs, allowing for ease of customization. These home retailers will also have color and material samples from this visit, and then we'll give some concept generation and give the user selection of these designs. We'll then work with these custom fabrications, these digital fabrication jobs which we're talking about, to give these custom parts. And these are kind of the partners that we would work with. The retail cost of this estimate is around $400, which for a custom ramp is extremely good, comparable to some of these aluminum ramps. And, yeah, so
moving forward, we need to optimize the design of the ramp to make it more lightweight, including some durability or reliability testing, and also just refine the manufacturing process from our prototype. Additionally, just looking at making sure we meet regulations for residential, and also really looking to keep the cost of customization down so we can bring the value to the users. Yeah, I'd like to thank Jack, our product sponsor, and also Morgan, who is our main user, or test user. So, any questions? So, it's actually split in half and folds, so it's only really sticking out when someone's going down it, and then it's easily folded back into place, not too heavy.
So, in order to make the fold, you don't have anything preventing them from falling off, tumbling sideways.
This is correct.
So, if the caster wheel is hidden at a wrong angle, one caster goes off, you've got an injury potential there as well. If you look at another place in ADA, it says that they're supposed to be
Yeah, some of the ways Enterprise have gotten around this is like marking their ramps as like dog ramps, and we really wouldn't want to do this for anything greater than like 2 or 3 steps probably. Yeah, because it would be kind of hazard.
And it is a risk. We did make it a little bit extra wide, and we've added traction on the surface, but this is definitely an issue that we want to address.
Everybody. The title of my project is Reawaken, and it's a collaboration between myself and NeuroSky. I'm currently getting over a little cold, and so if I'm not enunciating very well at some point, just let me know and I'll increase my volume as much as possible. So today I'm going to talk about narcolepsy and the limitations it places on people with the disease. I'm going to look at current solutions to the problem and discuss how those led me to my current solution. I'm going to look at the technology that I'm looking at and how I'm utilizing some algorithms to efficiently use that technology. Then I'm going to talk about some of the individuals who have collaborated with me the most and how their input has led to my final design. And finally, I'm going to go talk about some future directions for the project. So, but before we begin, would everyone please do me a big favor and humor me in a short activity? Would you close your eyes, please, or don't, keep them open, and picture yourself an hour after lunch. Community members, were you driving? Students, were you frantically preparing for this presentation like I was? And picture at this time that your field of vision darkens, and you have a sudden need to go to sleep. Does this disturb your plans for the day? How does this alter it? For me, it would have, certainly. But individuals with narcolepsy, you can open your eyes, please. Individuals with narcolepsy can suffer from several episodes like this on a daily basis. And narcolepsy is a chronic, lifelong condition characterized by periods of extreme drowsiness, sleep attacks, dreamlike hallucination, sleep paralysis, and cataplexy. Most individuals with the disorder remain undiagnosed and untreated, but conservative estimates argue that about 1 in 2,000 individuals suffer from narcolepsy. while there's no way to prevent, while there's no way to currently prevent narcolepsy, treatment can reduce the number of symptoms and the amount of attacks. Most individuals need to alter their lifestyle. They need to eat smaller meals during the day. They need to plan in daytime naps, and they also need to alert their supervisors and their teachers of their condition. In more extreme cases, individuals need to take stimulants such as amphetamines and antidepressants to help them get through the day. But these medications can also have serious side effects, such as irritability, anorexia, nervousness, and shakiness. So I also wanted to look at what sort of devices people with narcolepsy were utilizing as well. And for the most part, they're very rudimentary. Individuals use devices such as this life alert band, which just says that you have narcolepsy in the case that you have an attack. Other people will wear necklaces. In addition to individuals with narcolepsy, there's a wide range of people who deal with extreme drowsiness on a regular basis. And these can be pilots, long-distance truckers, or anybody who has to operate heavy machinery after a long day of work. And multiple studies have shown that operating machinery while drowsy is similar to doing these tasks under the influence of alcohol. So there currently exists no technologically based solutions for individuals with narcolepsy or others who deal with extreme drowsiness on a regular basis. This lack of support can lead to social, economic, and health consequences. And one study done in Denmark showed that the annual cost of narcolepsy is upwards of $15,000. It's my opinion that individuals with this condition would want to mitigate this cost and the social stigma by using a device. Therefore, the aim of this project is to design a technological portable device that can determine when a user is falling asleep and reawaken them. In order to accomplish this, I'm working with an incredible company that makes these affordable, portable EEG headsets. An EEG is an electrical recording of the activity in the brain. Each time our neurons interact, they produce a tiny, immeasurable signal. However, a dominant mental state characterized by the collaborative activity of hundreds of thousands of neurons can be measured and analyzed relatively easily. Now, in this project, the brain state that we're trying to determine is extreme drowsiness or sleep onset. And multiple studies have shown that EEG is a reliable indicator of drowsiness. Sleep onset is a completely different factor, and scientists don't fully understand this yet. And so we're not trying to determine exactly when the user is falling asleep. What we're trying to do is we're trying to find out when have their capacities been compromised by this extreme drowsiness. And there's a couple ways we can measure drowsiness to do this. Now, the NeuroSky provides us with five common brain waves in addition to blink strength. And the ones that are most important to sleep and drowsiness detection are alpha waves and theta waves. Alpha waves are between 8 and 12 hertz and are very common in the awake condition. When we begin to fall asleep or we get really drowsy, our alpha waves start to diminish, and it's the first sign you see. Later in this process, our theta waves begin to increase. And if we look at this graphic right here, this black line shows KSS, which stands for Karlinsky Sleepiness Scale. And that's just a subjective measure of each individual's sleepiness. And so they ask you on a scale of 1 to 10 how sleepy you are. You say, I'm a 7, so you're high. And so as we can see, as this black line increases, we see a decrease in alpha activity and an increase in theta activity. Now, in addition to alpha and theta waves, something else we can look at to determine sleepiness is blink frequency. As we get tired, I'm sure we all know that our blink starts to slow down and our eyelids get heavy. And so this is a really complicated graphic, but it's really important because it's cited in a lot of studies. And really what it's saying is that when people get sleepy, they move from, their blink frequency slows, and they move from an awake condition to a low vigilance condition to a drowsy condition and to a sleep onset condition. So what this device is attempting to do is it's trying to determine when an individual's alpha waves decrease, their theta waves increase, or the blink frequency slows. Once I had these criteria, I went to talk to some really extraordinarily helpful people. The first one on the top left here is Johnny Liu, who's the project suggester and director of the developer program at NeuroSky. Johnny helped me acquire a unit and also helped with a lot of technical support dealing with the NeuroSky, which is shown there. Omar McKenzie, who I spoke about earlier in the quarter, is one of my best friends and is a current individual suffering with narcolepsy at Yale University. Omar told me that if he was going to use a device like this, it would have to be comfortable, it would have to be lightweight, it would have to be easily removable, and it would also have to be very discreet. Jamie Zeitzer is an assistant professor who studies the neurobiology of sleep. And he really helped me think about what sort of stimuli I wanted to use to help individuals wake back up. Throughout the quarter, I've been debating between lights and horns and small electrical discharges, but Jamie helped me find out that vibration motors would probably be the most discreet, as well as the most efficacious way to wake people back up from sleep. In addition, Chris Holvey and Kevin Morey are two graduate mechatronics students in the class who have been extraordinarily helpful with the circuitry involved in this project, which is shown here. And the easiest way to visualize it is that the narcolepsy, which is reading in your brain waves, then communicates to an Arduino seen right here. And the Arduino you can think of as a mini computer. When the NeuroSky tells the Arduino that the alpha waves are decreasing, the theta waves are increasing, or the brink frequency is slowing, the Arduino activates these two motors up here that then ring in the individual's head and attempt to wake them back up. Another way to visualize that is through this. And on the right, this is the Bluetooth module, this is the Arduino, and these two up here are the motors. So I'm sure what you're all saying now is, I don't care who it is, no individual is going to want to wear that headset all throughout the day, especially now that you've put a box on it with some circuitry in it. And that's something that I've known from the very beginning and has always been a limitation of my product. And so this has sort of been a proof of concept trial for me. Now, I've used this device over the past 2 weeks, several weeks, to really test how it could detect my own falling asleep and my own waking up, and it has been relatively successful. However, individuals with narcolepsy have extremely distinct EEG patterns. And so the next step in my process needs to be to find more individuals with narcolepsy. And right now, I spoke with Terry Adams, and there are two registered individuals on campus, neither of which was particularly ready to collaborate with my project. So the next steps for me are finding these individuals and seeing if this concept works in these individuals. If it does, the next transition is to move to an IRB-approved research on the detection of extreme drowsiness and sleep onset in narcoleptic individuals. If this works, I'll then move towards a final, more aesthetically pleasing final design. Right now, what this is doing is it's communicating via Bluetooth to a device that's 2 centimeters away, pretty much, which makes absolutely no sense. And so what we would do in the future is we'd remove the Bluetooth capacity. This would decrease the weight as well as the cost and allow you to get a sleek, slim headband with multiple colors that would be accessible to a wide range of people. Thank you guys very much for your time and feedback throughout the quarter. I really appreciate it. Questions?
I noticed that the NeuroSky process, this approach is the only approach you looked at, but in your first, one of your first statements was that there's nothing addressing people falling asleep while driving. I've seen the commercials on television with the vibrating steering wheel and the other things that are built into cars now. How would you compare the success of this?
So the ones that truckers typically use at this point involve a accelerometer in the headset that notices when your head's beginning to droop and vibrates. And speaking with Jamie Zeitzer, who's really on top of all of this stuff, he was able to explain to me that truckers know how to dodge it. And so in their heads, they'll be like, okay, I'll just lower my head a little bit. I'll lower my head a little bit more. And it won't detect that they're falling asleep. Individuals learn to work around these sort of projects. Is that something that we have to learn to deal with this as well? And I think the way we do that is by varying the frequency of the vibration.
The concept of putting something on your head, of course, is a little awkward for a lot of folks. Is there no other way of perhaps measuring the wristband by measuring the pulse to other aspects of sight or anybody else to now potentially other paths of measuring the body?
So life activity tracker bands do this to a certain extent. Some of them do it by trying to measure your heart rate changing as you fall asleep. And others try to measure it by telling when your toe changes degrees by a certain temperature. That's another indication of sleep. I don't know how effective these are. I've been pretty focused on specifically EEG in this project.
I was wondering how you know wake someone up if they're falling asleep or just let them.
I'm sure that health-wise, in many situations, it's almost always safer to sleep. But if you're driving a car or you're flying a plane with people in it, I think it's safer to get to a...
Is there health risk if someone falls asleep while driving?
person with narcolepsy, if you wake them and continue to do that versus letting them sleep?
Nothing I have seen has shown that, but I think that during that IRB-approved research trial, if that happens, that's something we definitely want to look into.
And did Professor also say at what point it's better to wake them during the cycle when they're falling asleep versus when they're falling asleep? You know, at what point is there a mass connection to waking them?
Mm-hmm. So are they going to wake up right before they fall asleep or after they fall asleep? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, if your sensitivity of your device...
Mm-hmm. It's trying to catch before you fall asleep. So it's not waking you up, but telling you that you're about to fall asleep. Thank you guys again.
Alfred, and I'm a team of one. My product is my Inhalo. So I'm going to start off just talking about my problem. I listened to the suggestions that were made early in the course and liked the suggestion that Jules Sherbin made, which was how can we improve the Inhalo experience for people with asthma. And just to give you a little preview, my question boiled down to how can we make the Inhalo easier to use and easier to find. Oh, sorry, easier to find and easier to carry. My apologies. Okay, so just to sort of step you back through the design process, because for me, one of the most important things I learned in this process was just being comfortable with going from different spots and not thinking that you have to follow a linear or circular path. So you identify your problem, and then you go to S, to empathy, so you try to understand what's really happening. And then you define your needs, so you have a specific user, so you're not going all over the place, you know exactly who you're designing for. You ideate and prototype, so you're getting ideas. Then you do testing, feedback, and then maybe if you have to start over again, you start over. This will make more sense as I go along my presentation. So to give you a little idea of the research, so we're dealing with inhalers, we're dealing with asthma, and asthma is an inflammatory disease of the lungs which causes the airways to swell, and that makes it difficult to breathe. There's wheezing, it's coughing, it's not a safe situation. And some facts about asthma, according to the Center for Disease Control, in 2010, 1 in 11 children had asthma, and this meant about 7 million children had asthma. And one fact that I thought was particularly scary was the fact that 9 people die of asthma every day. So there are different types of inhalers. There's the meter dose inhalers, there's the dry powder inhalers, and the nebulizers. I decided to focus on the MDIs because these are more ubiquitous in society. So in terms of ethnography, I was able to speak with 4 sets of users. We had Zach and Elijah, his 6-year-old son. There was Kathy, she's a young adult in her late 20s. There's Christine and her 12-year-old daughter, Susie, who are here in the audience. And there's Heather and her 15-year-old son. So it was really nice being able to talk to these people because I don't have asthma, so I didn't have an understanding of what the situation was like. So just to give you some insights I learned from my different users, according to Zach and dealing with his son, he was very concerned about parent outreach and parent education in terms of understanding the situation of your child's asthma. He also said it would be nice to keep track of the number of puffs that were taken. And another thing that came up that I thought was interesting, that he wanted to help his son with the independence fact that Elijah tried to learn to use inhalers on his own. For Heather and her son, for Devon, he kept losing his inhaler. He thought it was loud, it made a lot of noise, there's a clicking sound associated with pressing down the canister. For him, in terms of appearance, he thought it would be nice to make the inhaler look better, but he thought childish characters were not his style anymore. And again, Heather wanted to be able to keep track of the number of puffs. Kathy. It was nice talking to a young adult, she's in her late 20s, so it's interesting to see her perspective. She was very much interested in discretion. She didn't want to be associated with her inhaler because she's found recently that she needs it more often, but she's also losing it, so she's misplacing it. And it was there was like a conflict of interest. She needed it, but she didn't want to have it around. So that was interesting to keep in mind. So from there, I sort of created this composite user where I wanted to be able to keep track of the number of cups that were left. I wanted it to be aesthetically pleasing, and I wanted it to be easy to find and easy to carry around. So in terms of things that existed in the market, there was a counter mechanism in Halo, which was an idea that I liked, but it wasn't necessarily pretty. And there was also, on the other side, just being able to put stickers on the inhaler, which didn't keep track of the number of puffs. So I brainstormed, and I prototyped, and I had this Play-Doh prototype of an inhaler casing with a counter mechanism, which is where I left you all at the presentation for my midterm. So from this point, I was supposed to go to testing, but that's where I ran into a problem, because who was I going to test with? I had created this fake user, sort of, and I didn't know how to go forward with testing, because if I tested one thing with the counter mechanism and I went to Cassie, she'd say, I don't really know about this counter mechanism. If I did the bright orange or the aesthetically pleasing and I went to Zach, he'd be like, well, I wasn't really talking about the appearance. So I had to start at square one. So with that, after talking to Jules and after talking to Dave, I decided to pick one user and to focus on that one user, and in designing for that one user, be able to be comfortable and satisfy her needs, and then see if it could be applied later on. So, meet Susie. I decided to work with Susie. So Susie, she's 12 years old, she's in 7th grade, she's very active, she likes basketball, she likes skateboarding. Susie didn't really care that much about people seeing her with her inhaler, because they know she has asthma, she knows she has asthma, that was okay with her. She wanted to be able to find it, though. That was her biggest thing. It was easily misplaced, and if it was 2 a.m. and she needed to have her inhaler, she needed to be able to find her inhaler, exactly. So my problem statement was that Susie needs a way to locate and store her inhaler, because it's inconvenient and potentially dangerous if it's misplaced. So these were the current devices that I thought were similar to what I was looking for. I liked that there was a key for a hook, so it was easily, you know, she could put it on her bag or like hang it somewhere. But the fact that it looked like an inhaler made me think that if you could lose an inhaler, you could lose this, because it looked the same, basically. So I went back to ideating and prototyping. I tried maybe looking at having a pouch. So if you wanted to be able to find your inhaler, have a place where it always was going to be, somewhere that you know this is where your inhaler is going to be, in your locker, in your room, somewhere like that. So I prototyped with different pouch ideas. I pretended it was like a glasses case, so maybe there was like a nice fancy wooden case for the inhaler. I pretended, like, wondered if there was a retractable keychain that it was just always connected to her finger or something like that, if that would help. So I did some prototyping. I made a pouch of basketballs, because maybe she would like a pouch. And then I also did a sort of casing where you could hook it somewhere and you could just drop the inhaler inside, and I have some samples up here. So Susie tested the prototype. So it was really nice hanging out with Susie and Christine and getting her reactions. She liked the idea of the hook to be able to put it in her locker. For the pouch, she wanted it to have a lid, so if it fell or something like that, it would still be sturdy. She said it could be glow in the dark, because she really wants to be able to find her inhaler, basically. And she also liked the idea of a lanyard, which surprised me, because I thought maybe she wouldn't want it on her person, but she was totally fine with the idea of a lanyard. So moving forward with the pouch idea, especially the idea that you could hook it onto something, I came up with a series of inhaler cases or inhaler pouches, so to speak. There was a hook at the back, so you could put a lanyard on it, or you could hang it up somewhere, you could attach hooks to it, so she could actually hook it up in her locker. I sort of tested it out. It can hang, and it can be hooked onto things, and it definitely holds the inhaler, and there's also space for maybe the spacer, which people use as well with inhalers. So I just highlighted some of the features, and so I played around with a lot of different colors, and with the fabric with the patterns on it, that's actually antimicrobial fabric, because I wanted to address the sanitary considerations with using an inhaler, because you're putting it in your mouth every day, and you don't want to carry a lot of germs. So in terms of moving forward, asthma isn't going anywhere, and there's going to be an increase in the number of people who use inhalers and the number of people with asthma, and I think that there should be a way to, one, integrate technology into it, so maybe moving forward, maybe being able to keep track of the number of puffs, or being able to have it hooked up to some database or some cloud, so that maybe parents can track what's happening with their children using inhalers. In terms of the actual pouch line, I would want to make it more customizable to the fact that we're using inhalers and the fact that we're using spaces as well. And in general, I think that we should be able to have more aesthetically pleasing pouches because inhalers aren't the nicest thing around, but people are going to have to be using them all the time, so why not have them look good? Ooh, there's a thank you, right? Thank you to Dave and to Jules and to my introducer. Any questions? I don't know the next name, but like the feature was that it's antimicrobial. So it,
Mm-hmm. It's nice. I like your little design.
Thanks.
It's very nice. I might just have to work a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, it seems to me that kids these days, whatever, only have one easily.
In some cases.
Like
yeah.
And what you've done here is a really nice little case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you maybe combine that with the inhaler together. And that would encourage them to keep it with the iPhone.
Oh, as well. That's true. Okay. Okay, that is a good idea. Because I guess as I prototyped, I realized that I was essentially making a pouch and just making something that was small and easy to carry. So it definitely could be extended and sort of manipulated to make sure that they have the inhaler as well as the thing that they're definitely not going to forget.
And you may get to the point, something I don't know now, whether they have it, but a Bluetooth type thing in the inhaler.
Mm-hmm.
Could actually work with some kind of app on here so they could track
as what's happening. Yeah. That's true. There actually is a product that I think has been beta tested which basically does what you're saying in terms of being able to, it has a sensor at the top so it can track like the number of calls that's happening and it's hooked up to a database where I think they should have one. Yeah, I agree. Okay, thank you.
Sean, good afternoon. I'm the sole member of Team 2 Clean. I worked very closely with Molly throughout this entire project. This is something I kind of left out of my midterm presentation. Was kind of an explanation of what my problem was. I thought it was a very simple problem to understand, not so much to solve. But it was just very simply create something that will clean the wheels of a wheelchair without using your hands. And I definitely left that out of the first one. I thought that was a very important point to touch. So this problem affects a lot of people. And basically, it's if you go outside with a wheelchair, you're going to get mud and dirt and all kinds of gunk on your wheels. And it basically affects anyone who's in a wheelchair. Manual or driven, I guess. And though it probably is more towards the motorized wheelchair because this is more likely the type of person who's going to also have trouble cleaning their wheels. So I will just briefly touch what I talked about during my presentation, or my misinterpretation of kind of what's on the market currently. And they have this hospital wheelchair cleaning device, which is basically like a dishwasher for wheelchairs. And then they have this no tracks device, which is pretty close to what I was going for, but had very low washing power and no way to hold the waste, and was close. It was very, very close. So here's a quick statement of need. This was kind of after speaking with Molly and kind of looking at what was already out there. We saw that we wanted more cleaning power. We wanted both sides of the wheels to be cleaned. From the statement, a hands-free way to do it. And I added that I want it to be pretty simple and low, just very simple and very robust. No electricity or anything that didn't need to be there. So I guess I can go over some of the key benefits here that I was looking for. Like I said, I was looking for something that would stay out in the rain, in the wind, and be able to be left outside. I didn't want any cords or electricity being mixed with the idea of cleaning your wheels with the water. There are some things I felt my prototype had advantage over was the cleaning power. The ability to kind of collect waste that can then be transferred out, and its ability to be left outside. User testing, I'll kind of touch more on this later, but I spoke with many users kind of just on a interview basis, and spoke with Molly once a week, and really she was very much involved in every step of this process. Safety was something that came up, and as you can see, I didn't have a chance to do it here, but I think guardrails would be a great way to kind of really up the safety on this. So I'll talk a little about user input, because that was a really, really huge part of my whole design process. So working with Molly, we came up with an initial design review, kind of told me what she wanted, and I asked as many questions as I could at that time. I then kind of thought over week by week, and we would meet on Tuesday after class, and I'd show her, oh, I just got this new thing, come check this out, or I made this, come try it. And it would work or it wouldn't work, and then we'd make adjustments for the next week. This is very much a trial and error. You can see here, this was a cardboard prototype that was trying to get the spacing right, which was very easy to just take apart and glue back together while she was there. And then we moved to a kind of the thing you see here, kind of to get, again, spacing and then height, and we ran into some problems there, so it was good to be able to work those out. And I also just want to touch that while I worked very, very closely with Molly, I didn't have side in interviews with people at work that were in wheelchairs, and just I tried to talk to anyone I could, though this was very much towards Molly's needs. So I was going to have this quick demonstration, but I guess in kind of light of time, I'm going to just kind of talk you through it. With this, I first wanted to kind of make a full woodworking prototype that did it all, and I realized that it was going to be very hard to do, like, out of wood, and it was kind of a waste of time, because it wasn't going to be made out of wood, it was going to be made out of metal, and I really wanted to use one-way bearings, so you could roll up onto it, freewheel your wheels and roll back, and then when you rolled back, it would lock. And this is very expensive and wouldn't really work well with wood, so what I decided to do was make different features of it and then test those individually, kind of things that could be put together so that if one thing did work and something else didn't, I could just fix that thing, but still have a portion of the product that was still working. So I can run you through a couple of those. Here, I'll show you just half of it. I was working with the plumbing, and this would fit right here, and it lined up with each of her wheels. Something that I quickly found with this guy is that I was kind of feared that it wouldn't give you a good amount of pressure, and that was very true. I plugged it up, even with just a half, and it just trickled out. So I think definitely researching into that with a nozzle or a smaller tubing or more water pressure would be the next step. But this was a very easy thing to for me to see, it was easy to build kind of the jets where you need them, but it was hard to get the correct amount of pressure. I also built this ramp, which was actually much harder than I thought. I thought the ramp was pretty simple. There was a lot of clearance issues, things getting caught on the bottom of a chair. I had to build up different parts of the ramp so that they were more sturdy and took out parts that were kind of catching. And this is actually a very useful tool for me to kind of get what does it take to actually get up three inches on a wheelchair, what's the correct slope. This one is kind of steep. We decided that maybe we were on this a little bit longer, that would then fold up. So it was very easy to kind of have Molly drive up on it and then quickly see, oh, that's never going to work. She can't even get on her. Oh, yeah, it works, but it's not going to work every day. So, like I kind of touched on, coming up next, I do want to continue this project next quarter in ME 1-13. The next thing is I want to move to a metal prototype, in which I can use these roller bearings that would allow you to drive it one way and not the other, metal. And then I also want to take closer attention to cost. Because kind of with the prototype, I just was putting things together without thinking too much about cost, but I would like to keep this, pretty reasonable cost if possible. Thank you very much. If there are any questions, I can take them now.
Is there a reason why
what's going on here is, under here is going to be a basket that will catch waste. I kept up on wanting to make the basket, and then every time I started to make it, it was like very simple. It was a box with wheels. And then I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll just do like this one other thing first, because that's super, super easy. And I just never got around to it. I really don't fear that I can build a box with wheels. I don't think that it'll be too difficult to do, so I really wanted to, work on things that I was scared of. To answer your question, that's why I need, there's going to be a waste kind of basket that the water drains down to the center and falls through and gets caught in a grate, letting the water run while the dirt and muck gets caught there. And then every so many uses, you can then pull the waste out and take it to the curb or the bushes or wherever you want to put it. Any other questions? Thank you.
Hemiplegia is where one half of your body becomes completely paralyzed or semi-paralyzed. And this makes it difficult to do everyday tasks, including putting on socks, because it's hard for them to bend over. Yeah.
Yeah, nobody ever thinks about wearing socks, but they definitely have a lot of important benefits. For everybody, it's a way to absorb sweat. And you know, you don't think about it, but the feet are actually the sweatiest part of the body. It absorbs that, which, you know, keeps the foot clean and
stops you from getting athlete's foot.
If you have diabetes, then there are diabetic socks that are low pressure that allow blood to flow better. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's compression socks that constrict the leg that prevent blood from cooling the leg. So the socks come in all shapes and sizes, and we're trying to create a device that kind of fits all of those needs.
So we had two interviews. One was with Deborah Kennedy, and what's your name?
And Jackie. And this is kind of the advice that they gave us.
So we need a device that's going to be obviously easy to use. It's not going to require excessive strength. People who suffer hypoplasia don't have a lot of strength in general. And also, it's not going to require the user to bend over.
Absolutely. So these are some of the ideas that we scrapped along the way. We have this crazy, like, mousetrap contraption that we call pulley system floor mount, which didn't even make it to the slide because it's just too crazy. It'll never work. So the pulley bullet design, so I can use the laser, which is right here, which I have in the back, but it's also a death trap. Well, we've got the claw idea, which is probably the worst idea of all.
It's more effective at drawing blood than putting socks on.
Also, the food idea was, really,
it didn't make it fruition, but it had some problems.
So, we've got the final five here. Wade wants to take this.
Okay.
So, I'm actually going to demo it. And on the slide, we have some of the design considerations that we were thinking about while we were kind of constructing this, gluing pieces on, stripping them off, saying, oh, that's an awful idea. So, the first thing that I'd like to talk about is the location of the pulling axis. On the original device, the pulling axis, which is the laser for that, was pretty high of the green one.
The green button,
up near the top. And what that would do is like lift the device, and I've got it here. This is our final product. It would lift the device, so it's like torquing it upwards. And when your foot is in it, they'll never, it's not going to go on. The biggest...
It was also closing the device up when you'd pull on it, so that was a problem.
And we added kind of a no-slip outer surface to the base of it. We were trying to think, what kind of materials were used. We used Dyson, which is kind of like the best no-slip material out there. And once we tried it, we stuck a whole bunch of Dyson plastic on, and it was way too much. It was like we tried to slip the sock on, and like, okay, the sock stayed on really well. And I tried to get it on my foot, and I thought, oh, this thing is not going to come off my foot. Because the sock was kind of attached now to the device, and trying to remove it just wasn't going to happen. A big challenge was the low friction inner surface. With the original plastic, which I have here, it's not the slipperiest. It has a decent coefficient of friction, and we needed something that would just kind of slip and allow the foot, however sweaty your foot might be, to just slide right on through without getting caught up on anything. Another thing we edited to this was a slope or a flat heel. The heel of the device was initially sloped, and so the heel was raised off the ground about a centimeter. And from the beginning, I kind of thought this may be a problem because your foot itself, kind of there's a ball of the foot, the toe, and the heel, and there's kind of this arch in the middle. And that arch of my foot, when I kept playing with the device, would always get stuck on that ridge. So we decided, let's just chop it up and sand it down. And now we have kind of this totally flat bottom device that sits flat on the floor, and all you have to do is just slide right up. And I'm going to start getting set up to demo.
So originally, the rope section did not have this extra plastic piece on there. And what that does is it pulls the... It'll pull these with the connection points out and open up the opening for you to slide your foot in, and also allows for easy use, easy grip with one hand, especially when you're finishing pulling it on, as he'll demonstrate in a second. Yeah, just let him get ready here.
All right, so I'm going to start with kind of the device on my lap, and I'm going to bring it to you already. There you go. holding this securely between my thighs. I'm not really squeezing on it at all. One of the things we had in the original product was that you had to squeeze the thing like this, you know, to get the soft arm. But for ours, you know, we took the crux out of it. So we don't really have to do that. I got a line of heel, so I know it's going to go in the right direction. And I just flip it on. You know, pretty secure. Next step, gotta pull down on the sock. Take a little time. Gotta pull it down. Pretty simple. Make sure the heel's in the right spot. Big thing that we added was kind of this control box. Now it reminds me of what I'm wired to, because it's more than we gotta hang on to. So now I'm kinda aligned with my toe, and now I'm not really using the control bar right now, but I've got my hand underneath my knee and I'm just gonna lift the leg and kind of push my my toes a little bit into it.
So it's not an unnatural motion at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be a pretty intuitive motion.
Okay. There you go. My toe all the way in. The bite is still kind of semi.
So moving forward, we definitely want to use a more official material on the inside besides just sticky paper,
yep.
Maybe like nylon or something.
Paper,
yeah. And also maybe make a mold that incorporates these side tabs here, turn into a single plastic mold. Yeah.
Yep. So. And of course we want to thank Gabby and Jackie for helping us out all the way through.
Any question?
I'm assuming this is for 8 to 5 people that find their feet to put on regular socks. What about people with disabilities whose feet are locked and to the right ankle, or who have to wear compression stockings, which are much more difficult to get on?
We didn't design it for that. We designed it for people with hemiplegia, and we assume that. Different design concepts and sort of ended back up where we started with the Norco aid. And when we first started using it, we didn't realize how good it was. We sort of underrated it, but it sort of takes care of a lot of issues that we ran into when we did other designs. So we just figured that, if we want to make improvements, we got to do some sort of modification. And so we came up with some of the important modifications on this are this non-slip on the inside is huge. Like, because when you use this before, like some sort of non-slip material, your foot would constantly be getting caught on there, and then be like, and you just like you couldn't move it in there. It wouldn't slide easily at all. Having these not directly attached up to the top part here and further out helps actually open this up when you pull. Before, when you pull from here, it'd be closing the device when you're putting it on. And then, so that was also huge. This handle wasn't as important as improvement, but it did make it a lot easier. We also, with these two blocks here, it's sort of, there's a huge problem with this thing rolling around on the ground because it's just a half pipe. So this definitely stabilizes it and causes it not to roll when you're putting your foot on there. And also, with the other one, it had a lip here, which we flattened out. And with that lip, when you pull on it, it actually causes this thing to flip backwards like half the time. So we made a lot of little modifications. It's not a completely new device, but we think these modifications were pretty important. Yeah. Yeah, I was actually able to use this one with the...
We learned the width I have the exact same foot size. We're lucky to have.
We do.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Before we head out, I want to thank all the evaluators. Thanks for filling out the forms. Thanks for the students for their excellent presentations. If you're going to be here on Thursday and haven't done so already, please sign up for food. We're going to provide food, not for bringing food, but we'll be providing food. Yeah. Thursday during class time. Come here. Yeah, 2 days.